Hi, Dave. Welcome. Today, I'm joined by Jackson from Palantir Vision. He runs a YouTube channel that focuses on stock investing, mainly in Palantir stock, PLTR stock symbol. And he's been killing it with his YouTube channel. It's approaching 50,000 subscribers. And we want to dive into the bull case on Palantir and really examine it from different angles. Want to welcome you, Jackson, to the show. How are you doing?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Dave. It's an honor to be here. Been following your work almost since the beginning for a couple of years now. And it's just, I'm very excited for this discussion and looking forward to kind of furthering the conversation on Palantir.
Awesome. Yeah. I think, just this new generation of people who focus on, let's say, a stock or a couple stocks and really just put in the work, build an audience. I think this is a new generation of stock analysis and research. So I think you're definitely in the forefront of doing this, focusing on Palantir. And, you know, a lot of analysts, like this is just a side topic, but a lot of analysts, they're covering like 20, 30 companies and they have a small team and it's hard for them really to dive into deeply into one company. I just think, you're doing a great job so far on Palantir and I want to extract as much, you know, wisdom and knowledge about the company from you in this limited amount of time. And I have a bunch of questions myself, but before we dive into that, first I want to just ask you like how you got interested in Palantir. And then second, we'll dive into a presentation that you've prepared for this video, giving an overview of the company, their mission, you know, their financials, whatever. And then third, we'll go into some of the concerns and issues that I might be seeing, but I want to discuss that and see, you know, what we can come up with. So yeah, first off, how did you get interested in Palantir? What about this company like stuck out where you're dedicating a whole YouTube channel toward it?
Yeah, so it actually goes back a little farther. So in November or December of 2019, I actually started a channel to sort of talk about Tesla, but soon realized how sort of crowded the market for YouTube or Tesla YouTube is. So I sort of rebranded and went for a more general focus, calling myself the investing opportunity. But again, as you even mentioned yourself, to be talking about so many different stocks, you sort of lose an audience, but also to what end are you looking at this massive portfolio? It's hard enough to focus on one stock. Why would you want to really dedicate so much time to such a broad portfolio and that you're really losing sort of the essence of why you're invested if you can't actually stay up to date? So I am more than grateful for all of the work you and the rest of the Tesla community does. It's a very well sort of aggregated community on the Tesla side of things. I didn't really see that for Palantir. So I was making some videos right when they went public and sort of started gaining an audience there and got more and more interested in sort of the mission and what they're actually doing and the potential for the future, looking at the TAM and saying, this is really understated at this point going into the future and seeing a lot of misunderstandings because this is a so-called secretive company from many in the public, some FUD, just sort of basic misunderstandings, but also sort of digging deeper myself because of course I don't have all the answers. I'm not actually able to sort of look at their product, but And also that being said, there isn't a consumer product, which means it's sort of harder to research on a retail side of things. But yeah, basically sort of switched over from a general channel to focus on Palantir because I was gaining a lot of subscribers interested in Palantir. And I just wanted to see kind of what this company is all about and build a community around it because, I was really excited about what they were doing.
Awesome, man. Let's dive into your presentation and let's get an overview of Palantir, if you don't mind, and we'll go ahead and screen share here.
So basically the main premise here for Palantir is this is a data analytics play. And the farther you look into the future, the more data there is that exists. And the more data there is that companies need to be able to sort through, to aggregate, to compile, because the number of connected devices is ever increasing. And if you really think about it, Starlink and SpaceX and Elon and many other players are actually going to work on in the coming years getting the other half of the world online and connected. And that's just going to blow up the amount of data there is and that companies need sorted and aggregated. And actually, it is a competitive advantage to be able to generate insights and make predictions based on the data that you have. So basically, that's just the very main overview of Palantir. Here's the platform. This is a look into the Palantir Foundry platform. I wanted to give that in case no one's ever seen it, but we have this no-code, low-code environment into which you feed your different data sources, and it'll actually pull from the data silos that exist. So if you have different data formats, Palantir's worked for a very long time on being able to feed those all into one platform. And you have all sort of sensor fusion, if that exists. I know you had Dan Ives on a couple of days ago, and he was talking about Wejo, which is in fact a SPAC that Palantir is working with. But perhaps we can touch on that in a moment. So the main solution, right, is to, as I already said, take all of this data, ingest it, and really be able to make simulations based on the data and actually make predictions. And what Palantir actually does is they create a digital twin, which is a replication of the data in which you can sort of say, what if we change this? What if we, in Wejo's case, change some sort of, because Wejo is a connected vehicle device, not device, but data company, and they're working on all sorts of traffic and safety stuff with some OEMs, and they can say, what if we change the sort of traffic light control setup? How does that impact our data and our safety or whatever else? So now I just wanted to mention this because you had asked me to present the bull case. And this is a quote from Alex Karp, which he said on the day of the direct listing back in September of 2020, calling Palantir to potentially be the most important software company in the world, and there will be a consensus that Palantir is a truly special software company. So that is, of course, his opinion, but what is his evidence for that? Because if you really think of the implications for a statement like that, what is the most important mean? Is there so much, like how much value is associated with the most important software company? So I just wanted to break that down. We have the other half of his quote. So how is he substantiating that? He was saying by delivering the world's best and most efficient software. So once again, not the most specific of quotes in terms of how they're actually going to go about fulfilling that. But this is my sort of view on Palantir at this point. These are the six main reasons I love Palantir as a company. And now we can talk about the company and the stock. That really exists. The divergence really exists for all companies and stocks that that exist. But let's just dive into this. I'm not talking about valuation, not talking about leadership, any of that. But we're starting with the product offering. So I think Palantir, as far as I can understand, it has a really robust and fully developed product offering. And they started, it was actually Peter Thiel, and anyone can go look into this, Dave. I know you wanted to kind of move beyond the basic view, but started Palantir coming out of PayPal, where they had all of these fraud issues and they needed to sort of address fraud. And PayPal was really struggling with the amount of fraud they had to deal with. And then Palantir came out of that and sort of started doing intel and defense work, started building out. And then they were like, oh, what can we do with these commercial companies that want to use our software? They eventually developed a commercial product. But Palantir has been working on these sort of problems for 18 years. So I think they really have a head start in a full stack solution for their products. And you really see, what is the proof of that? Well, you really see that with their partners. And I mean, the US government, we have all of these commercial partners, and that's basically just quickly touching on the products. Now, onto the culture.
Actually, hold on one second, Jackson. Sure. Let's take a quick break here. So you're calling Palantir, you know, a data analytics play. Have you looked into much like the comparison between Palantir and a company like Snowflake, where, you know, they're allowing, you know, companies to pull their data, to analyze their data? It seems like Snowflake's approach is more like this, you know, software as a service approach. Palantir seems to be a bit more, it's not a self-service thing. It's more like a consulting, like they set up, you know, shop, they set up, you know, a lot of hands-on expertise to make a customized solution. I mean, sure, they reuse most of their stuff, but it's still, you know, within that organization that they're helping a customized solution in some ways. Do you see Snowflake as a competitor to Palantir, or, you know, what's your take on those two companies?
Yeah, so the way Palantir would address that, because I've heard this before, it's, so are you saying, is your read on it that Palantir is more of a consulting sort of service?
Well, I guess, for example, with Snowflake, you can kind of go and you can sign up, and it's more like this service where you don't need, like, you know, Snowflake's personnel to come in and to help you actually just can download and start using it. It's basically software as a service. It's a web service in a sense, to analyze your data. So you can use a little bit or a lot, and you don't need any, you know, Snowflake personnel. With Palantir, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is it doesn't work like that. You can't just download Palantir software and start running it. Palantir comes in with personnel, with software, with engineers to customize a solution for your organization. Of course, reusing a lot of their platform, but it's still a customized solution, and they have like engineers, people on it. So it's not like a self-service platform. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong with that.
Yeah, to an extent. So the way, because Palantir is working with these enormous enterprises, mm-hmm. the way it is set up is you would actually, well, I was going to touch on this in the growth by design, but Palantir has sort of three phases they identify for a commercial contract, and that is first the acquire phase. So in that phase, they're actually sort of getting to know the company they're working with, sending out a forward deployed engineer, which is that engineer you're talking about, to help customize the software to a specific department and, say, pull in the modules that they've already developed to set it up and just sort of test it out, right? Because they want these sort of partnerships to work both ways. They don't want it to be helpful for Palantir, obviously, to have the contract, but not helpful for this actual company, or vice versa. So they're really sort of coming in and saying, we're going to set this up for you, because it is complicated in the way that it's set up. So they deploy that forward deployed engineer. And so once they're able to determine that this is actually going to work, they want to build it out a little farther. So they move from the acquire phase to the expand phase. And throughout this whole time, they're running at a negative contribution margin. So they're actually losing money upfront here on this sort of building out of the relationship. And then they're in the expand phase, or the acquire, expand, and then scale eventually. It's more of like a continuum of how well is this working, how far do we want to go, and do we actually put together a contract or a strategic partnership? And it is an interesting point, because back to the consulting point of view, because it's not entirely clear from an outsider's perspective, but the way Palantir describes it is it's not a consultancy. It's they deploy their engineer, and that's probably where the consultancy, I guess you could say, ends, right? Because they set it up, they distribute it throughout the organization. They need to actually, as you're saying, get it set up for the organization, and then maybe make a contract, multi-year deal or whatever, and go from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I guess the unclear thing is just the extent of the customized solution, like how much manpower. I mean, it seems like, you know, it would differ per client, obviously. Some clients, they could reuse, you know, almost everything. Some other clients, they would have to have some more customized, you know, solution. I'm sure for the governments, for example, they have to do massive amounts of customization, you know, probably hundreds of engineers, you know, working on different, you know, customized things. But let's go back to your presentation, and if you can go ahead and continue. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. So onto the purposeful culture. So this is what I had put down. Again, I was saying a point of contention being the stock-based compensation. And what they're really trying to do here is create a purposeful culture, create sort of a long-term view. I mean, this is obviously not the first time stock-based compensation has existed, but they're trying to sort of create this culture of the best engineers they can. Now, of course, they'll get beaten out by companies like Tesla, SpaceX, some other tech companies as well. But a main point of that is the stock-based compensation, where they'll actually stand a chance. So I just wanted to mention that. That is sort of the strategy, I guess you could say. And then on the macro alignment, this is really sort of the thematic piece to it. I think this is why ARK Invest loves it. As I was mentioning before, it's the data play, right? And that's, it's not just where it stands today. It's going to be where it is in the future. And growth by design, that was kind of just the three phases that I was mentioning, where they actually will have the client and the company actually be a loss leader up front, but they have this plan and strategy for positive contribution margin as they go, as the partnership matures. And then the network effects, let's see, what was I going to say on this? Well, so Palantir actually worked with Airbus to develop a Skywise platform. So it's actually, it's working with Airbus, but it's also working with 15 of the largest airplane manufacturers, and then onto 150 of the actual the flight companies. And really, what you see there is not just Palantir working with a specific client, but that it actually cascades down, because you have safety, you have the actual building and the manufacturing of the planes, but then you actually have the sort of the deploying of the planes or the flying of the planes, where those actually need to connect. So you have a customer of Palantir Foundry actually using Palantir Foundry, and that really creates a network effect, because you need to be able to talk to each other, right? So there's that there. There's some other examples of network effects, but we could potentially touch on that later. And then just the future optionality. It's really all of these combined. We've got the product offering, sort of the right mindset, as far as I can tell, for the future of all of this data and what needs to be done with it, and sort of the growth. That's really why we're interested in this company, is the growth and the culture. So if they can retain top talent, keep some of the best engineers, and really keep moving up in the ranks there, they have all of the building blocks for many exciting projects in the future, potentially a consumer product, a B2C actual platform for individuals, which could radically increase the TAM.
Mm-hmm, got it. Hey, so a quick question on the culture. So, I noticed, let's say take Q3 2021, you have Palantir has revenue of $392 million, and their operating expenses are $397 million, but their stock-based compensation is $184 million. So basically almost half of their operating expenses is stock-based compensation, which is very unusual actually for a company like this. And I think there are pros and cons definitely, but I actually think this is an interesting play, because a couple of things. One is Alex Karp is such an eccentric, unique kind of long-term thinker. And I think he kind of really attracts some possibilities and idealism from people. And second, he's asserting that he's attracting the best talent, you know, world class, right, engineers, and that this stock-based compensation is more than worth it, because ultimately it's going to be the talent that, you know, is Palantir's competitive advantage. So, yeah, I think it's a unique angle, where Palantir is not trying to just become an average company. They're really betting, you know, big, saying that they're willing to attract the best of the best and really pay half their operating expenses in stock-based compensation. And a lot of traditional analysts aren't going to like that, because it's just, it seems excessive, unnecessary. But for Alex Karp, it's like, that's essential, right? For his vision to accomplish what the company wants to. Yeah, is that how you're looking at kind of stock-based compensation?
Yeah, I heard someone say it's actually in pace with revenue, or it was at one point. Maybe that had something to do with the direct listing, because there were all sorts of expenses there. And I'm not going to pretend like that's such a great thing. It's really not liked by Wall Street, I'll tell you that. It's tough. At this point, I'd say it's not worth it, but it's definitely a point of contention. I'm not entirely sure, but it is what it is. It's what management is choosing to do. Personally, it's not the most straightforward option, in my opinion, because you look at the company and they have no debt, and they're choosing to, because they've actually paid off their debt, and they're choosing to dilute shareholders instead of just increasing the paychecks. I don't know.
I think the thing Alex Karp wants to do, he wants to get people on that are bought into the company vision, where they have ownership, stock ownership, right, long term, so he can get like build the culture that he wants. But yeah, I think it's an interesting move. Definitely not the typical move, but I understand where he's coming from. Yeah. If you don't mind, yeah, let's continue on with your slides here.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Because of course, that's what you were just saying. Here's a quick quote. We're in this for the long haul. If you're thinking about this short term, buy some other stock. We've heard this before, kind of echoing what Elon has said, just go ahead and buy some other stock, that sort of thing. Which is exactly what you would want a CEO to be saying if you're looking for a long-term investment here. So just quickly touching on Palantir today, 18 years old, two core products, about 3,000 employees, doing about $1.5 billion in trailing 12-month revenue. Around kind of the growth isn't altogether, it sort of bobs around a bit, but closer to 40% year over year. They did that in 2020 and 2021. And we're sitting at now under a $35 billion valuation. So basically, what I'm looking at here is not a quick play, not trying to trade it. I think that would definitely be a fool's errand with Palantir. We saw it in a bit of a range last year, and it has fallen out all entirely. So what I'm looking at is kind of going back to what you were saying is what really is Palantir doing here? Are they just a consultancy? Well, what they bill themselves as is the operating system for the modern enterprise, and that extends to the, sort of the government play. But I really think that's what they're doing, where they have a full software stack and all of these sorts of modules. And the further they can move downstream, the more their sort of addressable market increases. So if I made this sort of diagram image, which I think is pretty accurate, and what you see Palantir as, where all the controversy is actually them working with the government. So is this just a government contractor? Maybe just from first glance. But then you look a little deeper into the water, and they're actually down under the iceberg. They're actually sort of trying to address, they mention 6,000 companies is their TAM for the commercial side, which would be about $60 billion or so in revenue. And that is 60 enterprises that they're looking to sort of attack in that way. But that's not going to be enough if we're looking for a behemoth, a generational company, right? So we're sort of, as investors, trying to look farther down the road, what could happen in the future. Now, I was actually talking with Palantir. I had a chance to talk to Shyam Sankar, David Glazer, and it was just a callback that they had invited me on. And basically, yeah, they mentioned the Skywise example where they were working with this small airline, Peach Airlines, which only has 5 airplanes. But once again, the example of Palantir, so B2B, B2B being the Skywise Airbus, and then onto B2C, as I had already mentioned, another airline. So B2B, B2C is actually, I think, the sort of the next path, which will, again, unlock some sort of network effects down the way. So I think that's not entirely recognized as of yet. And then, of course, there's the mention of being the operating system for individuals, which I think, again, hasn't at all been mentioned by Palantir, but goes back to the future optionality. If they have this talent, as you're saying, this is the end goal, to have some of the best talent, to be developing some of the best software, they will obviously be able to do something with that. But again, I think it's a little early to speculate on that, but basically looking for this to be a multi-hundred billion dollar company.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Hey, a couple questions here. So you're talking about, you know, expansion possibilities here. Give me some feedback on how I'm looking at it. I'm looking at possibly there's, you know, four different type of expansion possibilities. You're talking about B2C eventually, business to customer. It seems like that is the most unrealistic, in my personal opinion, just in the sense that it's very hard for enterprise, like, for example, take an Oracle type of company or IBM or like a really software focused company, and for them to, you know, reinvent themselves for, you know, the customer, it's possible. Anything is possible. I haven't seen enough indication from Palantir management that's what their focus really is. It seems like it's more an insinuated type of thing that, you know, people are putting onto the company that this is possible, you know, in the future. Fine, anything is possible, but I want to hear it directly from, you know, the management that this is their top goal, right? 5 or 10 years out. I haven't heard it. Have you heard anything regarding that?
No, certainly not. But if you sort of look at their trajectory, it's kind of going as high as you can with the government, and then working down from actually enormous enterprises. And now they're working with IBM, AWS to actually sort of service these smaller to more medium-sized businesses, which actually I don't think when they filed for their direct listing in the TAM, again, they mentioned about $120 billion TAM, with half of that being government, half of that being commercial, and again, 6,000 of the largest enterprises, basically sort of Fortune 500 type companies. Yeah. But they have to be Western aligned, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like the other options for expansion are because here's the reality is they've taken the easiest picking fruits, obviously, because, you know, early on. So these are the biggest customers who have the biggest needs, the government, you know, let's say some of the largest Fortune 500 companies. But as you expand your offerings, let's say you're able to do more, then you get new customers, right? And then you can also, let's say, leverage what you have to get even maybe smaller customer, medium-sized businesses, et cetera, with newer product offerings. But the lower you go, the more you have to automate things. Meaning, you know, the larger customers is more hands-on. And that's been Palantir's bread and butter. But as they go downstream, they have to automate, they have to make it a little bit easier to use, expand what it could do for more people on its own, rather than, you know, them having to customize a solution. The question mark I had though is, and that seems like what Palantir is doing. They're going from government, they're going to large businesses, and they're going to, you know, medium-sized businesses. And the whole idea is, wait, Palantir can hit any business, right? Potentially. But in order to do that, it seems like to go to really, let's say, the small business, you know, market, which I don't even know if they have to, but let's say they wanted to, it seems like they would have to come up with a self-service product, something that, you know, you just sign up, you don't need a salesperson, you just download, you just start using the service as an API or whatever, and, you know, you're billed with usage. It seems like that's always the option call that Palantir possibly could do that could lead to this massive, you know, growth expansion. And they seem to be a company that's in the right position to do that at some point, but I haven't really heard their management really indicate that or really say that that's a focus, right? Self-service small business. Have you heard anything from Palantir management on that front at all?
Yeah, so they were actually sort of working on this Foundry for Builders type product, which is their flagship Foundry product, but it's actually catered towards smaller businesses that are working on building their vision. Palantir has partnered with some actual SPACs and staked some investments. So it is a strategic partnership in that regard. And also we have these alumni companies. So I'm just sort of explaining the type of companies that are using this product, Foundry for Builders. So we have alumni companies. It's an invite-only program and SPACs that Palantir has invested in to actually start using Palantir Foundry for Builders. This was announced last year. We've had two cohorts of companies using it. So probably around 15, 20 companies. They're piloting this program, and it is basically a scaled down version of Foundry. They haven't released too much about it, but I actually asked Palantir when I had the chance. I said, again, we had mentioned the 4 deployed engineers being necessary to for the large enterprise. And I asked them, is that necessary for this Foundry for Builders program, the 4 deployed engineers? And I'm just looking at my notes. Shyam said the idea behind Foundry for Builders is that it would actually be zero engineers, and customers are able to get up and running in minutes. They'll be able to use this on their own. They're able to build their core offerings, and it's targeted at the folks whose alternative would be a multi-year, multi-million dollar custom build sort of project. And then he went on to talk about the sort of time to value of what they're doing with their core product. So I think it's a matter of scaling down and making their sort of flagship Foundry more accessible. Because I think if that is true, if they are able to offer this as a self-service product with no engineers, obviously it right now you need to reach out to Palantir and to actually get approval to use this. But I think, is that sort of addressing what you were mentioning?
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. Yeah. That, you know, they seem to have some more smaller pilot projects. Okay. So another question here is, has Alex Karp given any like mega long-term concrete vision? And what I mean by that is, for example, Elon Musk, you know, back in 2000, I don't know, like early on, he was saying, hey, we're going to make, you know, this mass market affordable electric car, right? And then later on, maybe 2012 or 13, he would say, hey, we're going to make 500,000 of these, you know, mass market cars by 2018 or 2020. Actually, 2020 was his initial goal. So it's a combination of, you have an exact number of units, right? You have a revolutionary product, a new product that's addressing a big need. And then Elon followed up with this whole idea of 20 million cars, right, by 2030. So he has a clear number, a time frame, like a goal post, and it's clear what that will do. Like 20 million would just revolutionize, you know, climate change and impact. Has Alex Karp ever given something like that? Hey, 5 years, 10 years down the road, this is the number or this type of product or something, what Palantir is shooting for or going for? Is there any, I know he's given like a 30% or higher revenue growth for the next, you know, 4 to 5 years. I mean, that's, you know, a guidance, but that doesn't mean much to me. It's just numbers, right? I mean, it doesn't give this like, you know, a crazy ambitious goal that's tangible, you know? What's your take on this?
Yeah, it's a great point. I think if you look at sort of the development of Palantir for 18 years, I think their actual commercial product is about 6 years old, Foundry maybe. So if you really look at it, I know Elon had released because I saw you tweet about it, the Master Plan Part 1, 2006, and the Master Plan Part 2, 2016. And if you kind of just look at the time scale there, Tesla founded 2003, so about sort of like 3 years after, they were already thinking big picture. So for Palantir, I think it's a little different because of how they started with the government work. So I give them a bit of a leeway to sort of, and now they've had to sort of open up to some public, you know, like going public and sort of explaining the business model and all of that. So I don't think they can talk too much about the government side. But what Alex has said, apart from the guidance, 30%, whatever, is that they try and build products 5 years before the world needs them. Now, he says that a lot, how they're forward-looking and they built Foundry for moments of need, where I think they've done a lot of explaining how Foundry was helpful during the coronavirus pandemic. But that's a question I would like to ask him is, can you explain what you mean by being able to build products 5 years into the future? I don't know. Did you ever read on that? Have you heard him say that? That's pretty much the long-term sort of topic I've heard from him.
Yeah. I mean, I want to segue this discussion into the vision of Palantir. I'm wondering if you could help me out here, where what I'm getting from the company is, in terms of like, why do they exist, right? What's the point? It seems like Alex Karpi, he's very principled in different ways. And it seems like one of his main reasons is he wants to strengthen Western democracies. It's a very almost like geopolitical mission in some ways, where he's like, hey, we have this crazy global changing situation where you have the possible decline of Western democracies, the rise of perhaps more autocratic regimes. And if the Western countries aren't equipped with the right, with the best software, this is could be a winner takes all like game, where you can see this massive decline in Western democracies, perhaps the end of democracy with the rise of autocratic regimes who could have stronger, better AI, better software for their governments. So it's almost this existential issue with governments where Palantir is saying, we're going to come alongside Western democracies, US and US allied countries, strengthen right their software expertise, both in civilian and let's say military uses across the board, to make their software capabilities much better than, let's say, China or some other countries. Therefore, we were preserving kind of democracy and peace in the world. That seems like one of the kind of key reasons Palantir exists or motivates Palantir. Is this the main thing you think of why Palantir is doing what it's doing? And then where does business fit in? Like, is that just an extra kind of business opportunity? Like, why do you even need that? Is it just, yeah, what's your take on all this?
Yeah, it's interesting. So kind of why Palantir came to be, again, with Peter Thiel sort of making this company and founding it, was obviously looking at after 9/11 to not only work on anti-terrorism, but to protect sort of, as Karp always says, the civil liberties and privacy. So not only to sort of create this technology, to bring it into existence, but to also do it in the right way, as they so often say. So I think, yeah, that was the founding of the company. That was what they were working on, the government side, from the beginning. So yeah, that's definitely the roots of the business. And I think they had then said, we're building this technology. Look what else we can do with it. We can sort of tinker with it. We can build it out. And then we can service these companies that also have sort of needs for their data. So I do think you're right that that is the core part of the business. But I'm not sure you should dismiss kind of this other side and all of the commercial growth that has come about just because that's where Palantir's founding was.
Yeah. I was just curious, like, it seems like they have a very ideological, at least Alex Karp does, with the government side, right? And strengthening Western democracies. But do you know what kind of his ideological vision for the commercial side is? Is it just to make businesses more efficient, you know, to make them more effective? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I haven't heard too much from him on that. I think you're right. It's to sort of strengthen these businesses that are aligned with sort of Western ideologies. I think I don't know. It's definitely a good question, and one that Palantir hasn't really talked about all of this because Karp isn't on the conference calls, and it's that is a bit of a sort of taking away from this bigger, higher level vision where he is the one kind of steering the ship for a longer trajectory. So, yeah, I think that is definitely a good point, and see if I can ask, because I actually do have a contact that was offering for me to see if I could ask any cool questions of Karp. So I will pass that one along.
Yeah, you should try to get him on your channel too. That'd be awesome. Yeah, I love that. I mean, he always has some interesting, you know, things to say. Hey, let's get back to your presentation. Do you have any more slides here?
I did something, so it might look different now. But so basically, if anyone's interested, these are the offerings that Palantir has listed on their website. So palantir.com/offerings. And I mean, you can read them for yourself. It does make me wonder, though, if Palantir is kind of spread too thin, if they're sort of, they talk about how they service 40 industries. And I just kind of wonder, like, that's great, but you only have 3,000 employees. Kind of, what's the deal there with actually being able to service all of these industries? But I don't know. I think it's great. They were able to sort of develop this cryptocurrency project called Foundry for Crypto, and yeah, it's all sort of trickling down to see what happens next. But yeah, I don't know. I am a little concerned with what they're working on day to day, kind of leading towards the long term vision. But I'm sure there's something there. I just wanted to put this out there, cover this in the beginning. But basically, it's to what Palantir's working on, their platforms to take the intangible information, turn them to actionable insights for alpha generation. Now, alpha is the key here because that's why Palantir actually has business. And here are some mechanics of alpha that I've listed. I just came up with this. I haven't seen it anywhere else. But basically, you have the functional alpha, where it's actually the solution to the data problem. Then you have monetary alpha, where paying for Palantir is actually saving you money, paying for Foundry or whatever it may be. And then time. This is kind of what they talk about with competition, so to speak, where you could sort of develop similar solutions, but your Palantir's competition, as they note it to be, is their customers' desire to build their own platforms and internal solutions. So when you do not go with Palantir, as I see it, you are sacrificing one or more of these three mechanics of alpha as I've listed them. So, and then I just go on to give an example of each. So Carp said they've helped deploy all of the vaccines in America. I wasn't able to find out if that's true, but I know they were working. They actually were able to adapt their Foundry software because of their work with supply chains and their sort of supply chain module, adapt it to work with governments in the United Kingdom, in the United States, where they were able to work on the distribution of the vaccines. And then sort of time-based, again, they always talk about getting set up and running in hours or days. And that really is sort of what I've seen as well with a few examples, because I'm looking for this evidence of alpha, this real sort of backing up of what Palantir is saying. So I was able to find a couple examples of that. I'm sure there are more. And the tricky part of some of this is there are not always public examples, but a monetary example I found was BP, one of their big commercial customers. They said they were able to unlock $50 million in working capital after setting up their ERP suite. And then just basically the sort of the follow-up to those slides is what are they able to do with this, right? Their ability to generate alpha. And that is, I think Palantir has struggled with marketing because they do so much, and the government side, they really can't talk about that much. They've done some great demos. Last year was their demo day. I'm hoping to see a new demo day this year, this month, or maybe next month, because they did name it the inaugural demo day. So I'm hoping we can see that again. But yeah, they're working on their marketing. I think they're getting better. They're making some short form content if you check out their YouTube channel, and just sort of explaining what they're doing. So I think being able to articulate the alpha that they help these companies generate is definitely a key piece to that. And what does that alpha carry on to? It's, this is why we're choosing Palantir. And basically, as you had said, Dave, this is the guidance for 30%. I don't know. Can you see my cursor, or is that not?
Yeah,
coming?
Yeah, I can see
it. You
that.
Do? Okay. Yeah. So the 30% guidance is Alex Karp's long-term guidance as the CEO for it's through 2025. So that's basically where it ends here. I believe this is right because I had put the trailing 12-month revenue and just multiplied by 1 plus the growth rate. So Palantir has been beating their guidance, be it quarterly or this annual guidance, by a substantial amount, closer to 40% in some cases. So I would expect them to be along the sort of distribution here, where we can just, I don't know, this is just sort of an estimate, a higher level view. The sort of revenue into the future really depends upon how well they're able to scale their commercial product Foundry. They've got a sales team up and running for the first time, because I know originally in the book Zero to One, Karp was against having a sales team, where he wanted to sort of do the sales himself as the CEO, because when you're making such a big contract or partnership with Palantir, you want to be able to talk to the CEO himself and actually hear from him. So that was great. But the bigger Palantir has gotten, they actually need to have a sales team. It's unrealistic to have Karp doing all the deals. So it remains to be seen how well they're going to be able to execute on that sales team. They've gone public. They have all the funding they need. They have $2 billion in cash, no debt. Let's see what can happen in the coming quarters and years. And I think the growth really is the story here.
Do you have any slides on any valuation kind of models at all?
Yeah, so I don't hear.
Okay.
I know we're, I kind of took up a long time, and now you wanted these slides to be a little shorter. Yeah. But the valuation really is a question mark. And the sort of trailing 12-month price to sales or whatever, it was up above 30, near closer to 40, maybe 35 at one point, when the stock was much higher in the beginning of last year. And now we see, sort of with this sort of hit to the macro, and following a largely disappointing for Wall Street quarter from Palantir, we've seen the stock fall significantly, where the price to sales is around 20. So with Palantir, it really is tough to value at this point, because the future growth is sort of uncertain, but we do have this anchor of greater than 30% growth. So I haven't really been thinking too much about the valuation. I'm more thinking about the bigger picture and sort of the potential here, but it definitely is, it's something Wall Street is trying to grapple with.
Yeah. Can I toss some valuation ideas out, and, maybe you can give me some feedback. Even if you can't give me feedback now, if later on, if something comes up, let me know. Palantir is guiding revenue growth of 30% or higher for the next 4 years, it appears. So let's say they have $1.5 billion revenue this year, but let's say hypothetically it grows at 35% per year for 4 years. In 2025, they'll have $4.8 billion in revenue. Let's say of that, $1.5 billion are profits. And let's say we give a 40 to 50 times multiple off of that at that time. 40 times multiple will be a $60 billion market cap and valuation, and a 50 multiple will be a $75 billion market cap valuation. So right now, Palantir's, you know, a little under $35 billion. So it's like a 2x in 5 years, in four, you know, maybe 4-ish years or so. Not bad, but I mean, obviously this is subjective. Maybe the multiples could be a lot higher than 40 to 50% of, but I'm kind of giving like $1.5 billion off of profits at 4.8, which is, you know, it's about a third. There's over 30% or so in actual profits, right? So this decent amount. So I mean, sure, profits could be higher, growth could be higher, perhaps multiples could be higher, but if I just use these numbers, I'm getting like maybe 60 to 75 billion market cap. But I mean, is there anything kind of I'm missing, you think, with this just general framework?
No, they direct listed at $10. So they thought around $20 billion was sort of the fair valuation. And we saw the stock absolutely skyrocket on, I think it was a lot of retail interest. And to your point, we have seen sort of the slow decline there, where I'd just like, how much is this company worth? But I don't know. What was that? What was the multiple you were using?
40 to 50 time multiple at that time. So, you know, 40
in 2025.
Yeah, off of $1.5 billion profits? I mean, it could be higher, especially if they're growing, you know, if they could. That's a big question, obviously, with these growth companies. You don't know what their growth rate is going to be in 4 or 5 years, because it could be hypothetically, like, they could have great growth. It could be higher growth in 4 or 5 years, or it could be lower growth, but that would radically change the story, obviously, and the multiples people give. So yeah, it's definitely interesting, tough call. Yeah. Do you want to go ahead and go back and finish up your slides here?
Yeah, sure. So we're kind of getting to the end anyways. Yeah. Basically, I was just saying that I don't think Palantir should be ignored. It's very divisive. We have sort of all of this media coverage, the controversy, but I think Palantir, it could go either way, as you're saying, buying the stock today, right? But I don't think Palantir should be ignored. I don't recommend people to buy or sell, but I think it is something that we need to watch develop. I was not terribly excited with their quarterly results this past quarter, but I think that was sort of seasonally weak, Q3. We'll see what they can do. I'm actively monitoring it, and we'll see how the growth develops, see what the sales team can do, if there's sort of an influx either way, getting more government contracts and all of that, and see how the margins sort of stagnated a bit, I think, with the hiring of the sales team and some other expenses along the way. But we'll see kind of what happens. I have been a little disappointed in the short term, but I don't think Palantir should be written off just yet.
Got it.
Yeah, so that was sort of the end again.
Okay.
The question is really the valuation.
Yeah.
But I've been sort of looking at the sort of the top-down view. Is the technology – I've seen many write-ups on the technology being as impressive as they say it is. So what does that mean? Well, I think investors are still trying to figure it out.
Yeah. On the note on valuation, going back to kind of the 40 to 50 times multiple, I think that if Palantir can continue their 30% plus growth beyond 2025, meaning let's say there's 2025 and they're like, for the next 5 years, we're growing 30%, right? Then the multiples can be a lot higher. I think they can get like 100 P over E, or, you know, it could be substantially higher. So if you just, you know, increase that multiple, if they're continuing to grow fast at that time, 100 times 1.5 billion, which is $150 billion market cap valuation, let's say in 4 or 5 years. So that, you know, that's a nice 4X, which would be great. But yeah, I guess the question mark is, fast forward 4 or 5 years from now, what is Palantir's growth rate, you know, for the next 4 or 5 years? That's the big question mark.
Yeah, so I think what we want to watch develop is, of course, expansion in government. I think they have a lot farther to go, and their commercial enterprise sort of big names that they're going after, but also kind of what are they doing? Can they continue to move down market, and is that significant enough to increase the top line? But that is what I'm watching.
Yeah, awesome, man. Great presentation. It's been helpful to just chat, hang out with Palantir, actually. I think it's such an interesting, eccentric company, doing things different. I want to ask you your take on kind of the ethics of the business, because there's some debate and also confusion around, you know, the company, what they do with the government. We talked about earlier how, you know, part of their ethos mission is to strengthen Western democracies. Also, they're very clear. They're saying that, hey, we don't keep the data, we don't store the data ourselves. We service, right, the client, let's say the government. So they're not taking government data. They're just being a service, right, to the government, applying, you know, software, AI, et cetera, to analyze this data. But I guess part of the controversy comes of how that data is used and what Palantir is enabling, let's say, people like the government. I think commercial side is less controversial, you know, because businesses do kind of what they do. They're trying to make better products, et cetera. But the government is more broader in complexity. So for example, you know, I was watching this clip on Axios HBO on YouTube where Alex Karp is saying, yeah, it's probably their software that, you know, finds the terrorists, and another part of the software that actually goes and kills the terrorists, or, you know, identifies where to bomb the terrorists. And then he also talks about, you know, ICE, the whole immigration, you know, department and Palantir's role, where he's not giving details, but it appears that Palantir software is being used, right, to track some type of illegal immigration, illegal immigrants to, you know, with possible detaining, you know, them. And a lot of this stuff, he can't disclose what exactly they're doing. But it brings up this question mark, which I want to just take a step back, which is the problem really that US and Western countries need to be stronger? Like, is that really the core problem that we want to solve? And the reason why I bring that up is because if you have a stronger, let's say, US and Western countries, but it's because of software, like that becomes their edge. Will it be tempting, do you think, for the government to use that strength to push down civil liberties, to track more, to surveil more, to monitor more, to, you know, like, is a stronger government really, especially with, you know, software and AI, is that really a great situation? Versus, let's say you have a stronger government because the government has this great software, but simply because economically the country is prospering and becoming stronger, you know, like, that's one thing. I kind of wonder if maybe Alex Karp has this view where, you know, maybe the fundamental problem is more of an economic type of growth story, where maybe US and Western countries are hitting a wall and experiencing a lot of just, you know, stagnancy. And to just patch that solution with AI and software, it makes stronger governments, but does it really, you know, give the government the right type of power? It seems like it could be abused. What's your take on, you know, this whole ethical, you know, dilemma here and issues?
Yeah, so I think mainly what they're just trying to do is just offer the better software and just offer the better solutions, as you were saying. I don't think they're, like, we have Thiel, who's on the right, and Karp, who is definitely on the other side of that. So I think the company is definitely not trying to be political. I think they're just trying to be of service to the government and help in ways that they can. So if there's something that the government needs done, I think that's just what they're there to do. They're not there to say, we're going to pick sides with a certain, you know, administration or whatever. I don't know. It definitely is a bigger question as to what they're trying to support. It is definitely patriotism in the country, yeah. Right? But I don't know. That's an interesting point as to whether it's the government or the economy as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Alex Karp would make the argument that the best way to support civil liberties isn't to antagonize the government and to distance yourself from the government, but rather, you know, to work alongside the government and to provide some extra accountability, you know, to have a third-party software company, independent, that helps you with AI, but it helps the government where they can't, you know, let's say, break the laws as easily as if it was a closed-door system. Therefore, Alex Karp says, hey, on the whole, we're going to actually help civil liberties, even though, you know, the governments get stronger with AI and data analysis. It's a thesis. He could be right. That's the thing. And that's why I think he says they're the most important or software company in the world going forward, because they have a huge outsized impact on the future of government. Alongside with a lot of businesses as well, right? But
yeah.
But in his kind of geopolitical paradigm of, you know, Western governments are in limbo. They're susceptible. They're vulnerable right now, and Palantir can make a huge difference, you know, on where the trajectory of these governments and the future of democracy goes. So, if he's right, then yeah, we look back 10 years from now and we're like, wow, this was, you know, yeah, one of the most important software companies in the world.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to ask you a couple more questions here. So you mentioned the Palantir demo. You're referring to the double click, right, event?
Yeah, so actually, yeah. I was referring to, because I was talking about got the Gotham demo if someone wanted to see kind of more of what
Okay.
Gotham
Yeah.
does. That was actually the demo day, their first demo day, which was this is what Foundry is, Gotham and Apollo, which is the platform that services those two and essentially provides the over-the-air software updates,
Yeah.
if you will. So I was referring to that one. They did a second. It's the beginning of a series, but
yeah.
they didn't really follow up the series, which was called Double Click,
yeah.
To sort of double click into the industries that Foundry services. And it was like life sciences and industrials, I think, was the first
Yeah.
one. I had asked, are we getting more of these? And
Mm-hmm.
yeah, I think they're coming to sort of explain, give use cases of the actual industries. And this is for Foundry, the commercial product.
Yeah. Yeah. The double click, I'll go ahead and link to that demo in the video description. I thought that was probably the best explanation of Palantir ever, just because you get to see real hand, like what it's doing, right? I think
yeah.
one of the things that most people don't understand is that Palantir isn't just kind of looking at data. They're actually providing like scenarios, like, okay, here's, you know, what's going on with your data. If you make this change in your business, let's say you, I don't know, you know, you do this a little bit differently, what are the outcomes that are going to be affected? And what's the scenario going to happen? What's going to happen to all these different variables? And, you know, and you can adjust all this stuff where you're almost playing with the future. Like you have the power to control all these different variables and ultimately make a much better decision, which is invaluable to companies. I mean, it almost becomes like this superpower tool where maybe in 10 or 20 years, it's like ridiculous that businesses didn't have this at hand, you know? It's that fundamentally changing, you know, in terms of how business decisions are made. That said, I'm wondering, with that type of, I mean, I guess the first question is, with that type of, let's say, significance or significant impact toward business, where you could actually like radically change their outcomes and decisions they make. I mean, is this something that you think is kind of at the core of, you know, their bull case for Palantir, that they're going to be the company that's going to do this the best going forward? And then another question, actually, just remembered, is Cathie Wood has this whole theory of the S&P 500 is at risk, like half the companies, because of AI and this creative destruction that's going to come from that. But then on the flip side, if you have Palantir just coming alongside these S&P 500 companies and providing the AI, right, these superpowers, then maybe you won't see the creative destruction, right? Because like these companies don't have to have the AI experience themselves. They could just hire Palantir. What's your kind of take on that as well?
So on the first part with it being a competitive advantage, that's what, I mean, that's the pitch, right? Is you will be uncompetitive without, as you're saying, you had mentioned sort of what they call the digital twin, which is you have all this data, here's your simulation sort of engine that you can play with and say, what's going to happen if we tweak this or do whatever. So you can imagine that if you're competing alongside a competitor that has this sort of product and the ability to do and play with and simulate certain outcomes, that you would be uncompetitive compared to that player in the market. And actually, in support of that sort of thesis, we've heard Palantir say that not all companies actually want to come out and announce a partnership with Palantir, be that for, I mean, of course, it could be sort of, they said, I mean, because Palantir is there's a lot of sort of FUD, but also like, well-placed criticism on the sort of the controversy. So there could be sort of downstream effects with supply chain and other partners that, sure. But the idea that you wouldn't want to announce a partnership with Palantir because you would make it public that you're working with this company that's going to help you well into the future, I think that is a key idea there. Of course, they can't tell us what kind of companies these are because that is private information. But I think that is interesting to watch going into the future to see if there's any development on the public side that we can hear about. But on to the part about the sort of Kathy would take, I'm not sure, because I think some of these companies, it's sort of like a structural issue where I think like big auto, like you can't just erase this debt, right? Or in some of these cases, I don't know. I've heard her take. I think it's an interesting take. I think I would agree with it. In some cases where like you get like all these incumbents, it's just too hard to navigate a world where you have all these innovative companies sort of coming up and they're able to move so fast and agile, and sort of, they don't have this sort of, all of these old legacy systems weighing them down in that regard. But then again, as you're saying, Palantir Foundry is designed to be able to unlock these legacy systems. That's what they say. And if they're able to do that well, maybe these companies do stand a chance. But I don't know. That might be too big of a picture for me to think about.
Yeah, I hear you, man. Yeah, fantastic. Awesome discussion. Thanks for coming on and discussing. Yeah. Palantir from different angles. Definitely appreciate your knowledge. Curious, just personally, where are you located?
Oh, I'm in Connecticut right now.
Okay.
I'm home for awesome. From college.
All right. So it's pretty cold up there, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's about 30, high 30s.
Okay.
It's not bad.
Not bad.
I'm used
okay.
to
Got it.
Are you in All Austin right now?
Yeah, Austin. Actually, weather's pretty good right now. In January.
Are you going to be the first one at the Giga Texas party?
We'll see. Yeah, I'm waiting to see when that's announced. It's going to be awesome, man. Yeah, it's great chatting with you, Jackson. I wish you the best on your YouTube channel, Palantir Vision. I'll go ahead and link to it in the video description below for those who are interested. Any other good Palantir kind of YouTube channels or resources that if people wanted to find out more?
Yeah, there are definitely some up and coming ones. We have the sort of the bigger players like Tom Nash, who's always on about Palantir. I'm sure your viewers are aware. I'm going to be talking with a couple sort of new ones that have just started to get sort of the technical side of Palantir that I don't have and I'm not able to share. But yeah, I think the more that Palantir, this was very recent listing, the more that other people are able to come in with a different angle, as you so often say, on Palantir, the better it'll be. And yeah, I'll be happy to tweet out a list of channels when I have a little more time to think about it.
Cool, man. All right, Jackson, take care. Have a good day. We'll see you, man.
Thank you so much, Dave.
All right, bye.